The following podcast is an Embassy Row production.
Hey everybody, I'm Mark Lamont Hill, owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. I am a professor, a scholar, and most importantly, a book nerd. I say book nerd because I don't just love to read books, I'm the person who loves to read about the book. I love hearing authors talk about how and why they wrote the book, and I love talking to other book nerds about their favorite books. That's why I started Coffee and Books. It's a podcast all about books. Every episode, I sit down over a cup of coffee with the world's biggest authors to discuss the most interesting, controversial, fun, and important books. Sometimes I just hang out with experts, fans, and other special guests to talk about some of the greatest books of all time. And today, I am joined by Carl Hart. He is the Ziff Professor of Psychology in the Departments of Psychology and Psychiatry at Columbia University. He's also a research scientist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. And he has a fascinating and controversial, but fascinating new book. It's called Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. Carl, good to see you.
Good to see you, Brother Mark, man. Long time no see. It's good to see you.
You too, man. Now, the first thing I ask guests usually is, what kind of coffee they're drinking. I, of course, am sitting here with a cup of plain black coffee to keep myself awake, to keep myself alert. I even get a little buzz from my black coffee. But I feel almost embarrassed after reading this book to ask if you even mess with coffee. Are you a coffee drinker?
Nah, man. If I want to get a little boost, I'll just take some amphetamine.
Right, that's what I'm saying, man. I said, this dude ain't got time for no coffee. This book, of course, builds on your previous book and over two decades of research around the question of drug use. I think when someone sees this title, Drug Use for Grownups, of course, as you say in the intro, this ain't a how-to book, but people are certainly wondering what kind of acceptance, what kind of support for the idea that drug use is okay is this book offer? Can you talk a little bit about, just from the beginning, what made you write this book and what your overall sense is about drug use among responsible adults?
Yeah, so the book is, if people only think that the book is about drug use, they're kind of missing the point. The real meat is in the subtitle, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. I'm using drug use as a topic because that's what I do. I study drugs, and so I can use my area to really investigate, interrogate, and grapple with this issue of liberty. Liberty, particularly in for Black folks, you know, it's like, we have sacrificed our liberty to use drugs and so many other liberties without even giving up a fight. And here, I'm trying to get people to think about like what it means to be American and what this liberty means. Essentially, what the Declaration of Independence guarantees us is that we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, meaning that we can live our life as we see fit. And that's what I'm trying to get people to understand. It's like, if you want to use drugs in your pursuit of happiness or as an expression of your liberty, so be it. As long as you don't mess with anybody else or prevent anybody else from doing the same or pursuing liberty in their chosen way. The topic of drug use becomes controversial because people have been so misinformed and miseducated about drugs. And this book seeks to help to diminish or decrease the miseducation as it relates to drugs.
Absolutely. And so there's a few arguments that you make in the book. You lean on your scientific expertise to talk about the scientific argument for why drug use is not or should not be seen as a non-starter in the pursuit of liberty. But you also talk about the kind of cultural stigma and the social stigma and the political weight attached to drug use. Let's start with the cultural stigma. Drugs are bad. You know, Drugs are scary. You talked about having to out yourself as a drug user, people having to out themselves as drug users, because you can't just say, you can say, oh, I'm a recreational, you know, I drink three or four glasses of wine a week, or, you know, shit, I have a glass of a Bacardi every day. You can say that, right? But if you say, oh, I do a line of coke, you know, even if once a week, you know, you can get some funny glances from people, no matter how responsible you are, no matter how committed you are to your profession, no matter how much you contribute to the world. Talk to me about the cultural stigma of drugs and why it's important to unpack that.
Yeah, so it's important to really think about the role of culture and what the role of culture has played in terms of drugs and how we see drugs. If we think about drugs like cocaine, the drugs that you talked about, cocaine or heroin, many people think that these drugs are banned because of some pharmacological reason, because of them being uniquely dangerous. It's not true. These drugs are banned because of cultural factors, and that major cultural factor is racism. If we go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, we can think about cocaine. Cocaine was in Coca-Cola. At the time, though, Coca-Cola was only accessible to white folks because it was only in the fountain drinks, and Black people were forbid from going to get fountain Coca-Cola. But then, at the early, in the early 1800s, early 1900s, Coca-Cola was bottled. And now Black people have access to cocaine through Coca-Cola. And also, they have access to cocaine through a variety of products. And then white folks who didn't like this started to marry cocaine's effects with Black people's drug use or Black people's cocaine use and bad behavior. So they would say things like, Black men who take cocaine rape white women. Black men who take cocaine engage in these heinous crime. If you want to stop Black men with bullets, you can't do it if they're on cocaine. You have to have these high-powered weapons in order to stop Black men on cocaine. Eventually, cocaine became banned. A similar thing happened with the opioids. A similar thing happened with marijuana. The opioids, of course, we married bad behavior with the Chinese. With marijuana, we married bad behavior with that drug with Black people and Mexican people. So we have to understand that drugs have been used, or these sort of effects of drugs have been married to Black and brown people as a way to restrict access to these drugs, not because of the drugs' pharmacological effects.
Talk to me about some of those effects. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, so break this down for me. You know, you break down the brain, you talk about MRI, you get into extraordinary depth about this. But at the core, the average reader of this book, the average person who talks or thinks about drugs, is beginning from a place of saying that the worst drugs, and by worst drugs, we mean these Schedule I drugs, marijuana notwithstanding, and Bernie notwithstanding, are the worst drugs. These Schedule I drugs are the ones that are going to do the most harm to you. They're the ones that are going to have the greatest chance for addiction. They're the ones that are going to do the most long-term damage to your body, maybe some reproductive effects, certainly memory, certainly performance. Tell me why that's not true.
I guess we should probably start with a drug. Let's just take something like heroin. And that way people understand. If we think about heroin, we have this notion that heroin immediately causes all of its users to become addicted, and they become slaves to the drug, if you will. That's just simply not true. Heroin is essentially morphine. The Bayer Aspirin Company in 1874 just put two acid groups attached to the morphine chemical structure, and then you have heroin. That's what heroin is. The two acid groups attached to the morphine doesn't produce any pharmacological effects. So when people take heroin, they're really just getting the effects of morphine. And we use morphine in medicine. Other places use even heroin in medicine because it's an opioid. If you've ever taken something like Percocet, oxycodone, you've taken heroin. It's the same drug, essentially. If you've ever taken morphine, you've taken heroin. But in our country, we have these narratives built up around heroin to suggest that it produces these inevitable, awful effects. It's just simply not true. Same is true with cocaine. If we think about cocaine, many of us have snorted cocaine, and we know that cocaine is a nice euphoric-producing drug. The effects don't last that long. That's probably the biggest problem, that the effects don't last as long. But there are other stimulants, like amphetamines. Their effects last longer. Amphetamines produce a similar effect as cocaine, except the effects last longer. All of these drugs are just pharmacological tools, and their effects are dependent upon the environmental conditions under which the drug is taken. So if you are taking something like heroin and you have no food, nothing to eat, you're an irresponsible person, yeah, you can probably expect some negative effects to happen. But if you're somebody who is responsible and you have resources, probably won't have any deleterious effects, but you're certain to have some positive effects.
Like what?
Something like heroin, relaxation, anxiety reducing effects. You might be more magnanimous, forgiven. You might be more open. Those are all positive effects.
Okay. You said that it's just not true. and you break this down in the book, you say it's just not true that these addictions are necessarily going to happen with heroin or cocaine. People are going to be skeptical of that claim. Can you dig a little bit deeper on that? And you get into the addiction numbers on this. I was actually shocked to see the addiction rates, particularly for cocaine and heroin, relative to what I would have imagined. I knew about the kind of crack wars of the 80s and the medical journals and the kind of fake science that said, you know, instant addiction and crack monsters and stuff like that. But they were always inaccurate in relation to powder cocaine numbers. At least that's the information I was consuming. But what I learned from your book is that it's not just that these things aren't as bad as other drugs. It's that the odds of us becoming addicted to these things, I won't say they're low, but they're, I mean, I think, what, was it 30%? Was it like 30%? I mean, it's high enough to some people, but yeah, it's far from the kind of assumption that you're going to be of instant addiction that people would have assumed. Can you talk about the numbers?
First of all, when we talk about these numbers, these are just general numbers. So on the high end, the chances of people who smoke tobacco of becoming addicted, about a third of the tobacco smokers become addicted. Something like heroin, about 25 to 30% of those folks become addicted. Something like cocaine, about 15 to 20% of those people become addicted. Alcohol is about the same rate as cocaine. Something like marijuana, about 10% of the users will become addicted. So you can see you have this gradation, or there's some drugs are more likely to produce addiction compared with others. But the important point for people to understand that is that the likelihood of people becoming addicted increases when the person has a psychiatric illness, when the person has another illness, like a pain illness. It also increases when the person, for example, had a middle-class job, and then the factories were gone, and then they don't have that middle-class paying job. It increases the likelihood that people will get in trouble with drugs, as well as get in trouble with a number of things. And so if you are a young, white male, underemployed, your chances of becoming addicted are higher than some other people's chances of becoming addicted. And so you can see that this isn't a one shoe fits all. It depends on what is at the beginning, what happens with the person. Has the person develop these responsibility skills to inhibit their behavior, to be responsible? All of these things play an important role in determining whether somebody will become addicted. What we've done in our society is that we made it seem as though it's all about the drug, when drug addiction has little to do with the drug, and it has damn near everything to do with the psychosocial environment in which the person is operating.
What do you say to the person who says, yeah, but that's a distinction without a difference? If drugs aren't the problem per se, but if you're poor or you're struggling with mental illness, you don't have access to proper resources, like you said, the factories are going away, if all this stuff is happening and drug becomes the proxy for all those messed up things in the world, then saying, yeah, drugs not the problem, it's the structural stuff. What benefit do we get from that rather than just not letting people mess with these drugs, knowing that they're going to lead to worse outcomes?
Okay. Let's be clear, drugs are not the proxy, drugs are the scapegoat. So we understand that.
Okay.
So what that means is that politicians, they can now say, we're gonna rid your community of drugs. And what that means is that we're gonna put more cops on the street. And so that's the problem. We put more cops on the street because we're saying we're doing something about this real problem, drugs. And that's not the problem, it's a scapegoat. And in the process, what we do is we hire predominantly white people, white males in these law enforcement jobs, jobs that are predicated on them incarcerating black and brown bodies. That's a major problem with that sort of thinking. Another problem with that thinking is that it takes away people's autonomy, their liberty, the very thing that the country says it's built on, our liberty.
I'm gonna talk about the liberty thing, and I wanna talk through sort of how we balance liberty with government intervention for ostensibly people's best interests, right? And of course, we may disagree on that, or people may disagree on that. For example, in a place like New York, there was a ban on sodas, on these large size sodas. There was or at least a conversation about banning, you know, 60, you know, you go to a movie theater, right, you get a 64 ounce soda.
Bloomberg decreased the volume. Yes.
Right,
yes.
Exactly. Because they're like, you know, we want to manage people's consumption of these things.
Yes.
In Philadelphia, they had a sugar tax. So if you bought certain kinds of stuff, you paid more for it. And the argument was, this is a healthier option. People can still do it, But this encourages healthy behavior. Whereas before, we were encouraging unhealthy options. You go to movie theater, you pay 10 cents more, you get the extra 32 ounces of soda, which takes you on the road to diabetes. Are there moments where where the government should intervene and protect people from themselves, particularly given the fact that we live in a society that encourages unhealthy behavior, unhealthy eating, unhealthy mental health? We stigmatize going to the therapist, then you have the option to do crack, right?
Yes.
How do you balance that? How do you make sense of that? And is it a threat to liberty to have those kinds of interventions? And to what extent should liberty be constrained within a society?
Yeah, so let's be clear. The sort of restrictions and the sugar tax, those items are still available in the society. And so when we drive our cars, we have similar restrictions. You can't go as fast as you want to. You have to wear seatbelts. All of these sort of things are to enhance the safety of that activity. But those activities are not banned. They're not prohibited, whereas drugs are prohibited. So that's a major difference. It's okay for a government to try to enhance the safety of an activity. That's the role of the government. That's why we have nutrition ingredients on the side of our products that we consume. That's the role of the government. Now, when we start to get into this issue about the government protecting me from myself, the government is not qualified to do that sort of thing. The same, if we think about Thomas Jefferson, who had his problems, he was human, of course, but the ideals that he espoused were, some of them were brilliant. And he made this sort of observation that, you know, people, if you allow the government to tell you what you can put in your body, then your mind will be in tyranny, basically, under tyranny. And I agree. And so as a responsible adult, I don't want anybody telling me what to do, as long as I'm not harming anybody or preventing those people from doing what they want to do. I mean, obviously, if you are harming somebody in your actions, well, something should be done about that. That's not right. We can't have a society where people are allowed to harm others or allowed to prevent others from enjoying their liberties. That's not right. But as long as they're not doing that, I don't want the government telling me what to do or anybody telling me what to do.
Are there any activities, though? It may not be drugs. I'm speaking more broadly now. It's yes. More of a philosophical question. Are there any activities that are so inherently dangerous that they shouldn't be permissible within society because of the likelihood of danger? So, for example, someone might say to you, marijuana has relatively low addiction rates, and the threat to society someone is or had or demonstrates when they are addicted to marijuana is relatively minimal. You know, they might eat your Pringles. You know, like, it's going to be something relatively small. I'm not worried about that. However, if even at a 30% addiction rate for heroin, that 30% is going to be such a danger to themselves because of mental health, because of poverty, because of all these structural factors, that it's not worth allowing it. How do you jive that? I mean, let's say if there were a 90% addiction rate for heroin, would you support it?
It all depends why people are becoming addicted. If they're becoming addicted for the same reasons that we are having today, no, I wouldn't support a ban on that. I mean, let's just think about every year in this country, 40,000 Americans die because of car accidents. Every year. It's been that way for about 30 years at least. Nobody's talking about banning automobile accidents. You know, in this country, peak heroin deaths, heroin-related deaths, and that's not even, we can't even say heroin was the cause. Peak heroin-related deaths was 15,000. And I think that number will go down dramatically if we legalize it, because the problems related to heroin have more to do with the adulterants that are put in heroin by illicit dealers. And that's more of the problems. And so, look, as a human participating in activities that potentially brings you joy or that you seek to bring you joy, there is always danger. And we will never eliminate all dangers. Anybody who thinks that we will, they're crazy. They may as well stop listening to this conversation. I fly in airplanes, you fly in airplanes. There is inherent danger because if it crashes, we're most likely dead. Nobody's talking about banning airplanes, and there have been crashes. And so there are these activities that we engage in. What we try to do is enhance the safety associated with the activities, but not ban the activity.
One of the things you talk about in the book is shifting the language away from harm reduction. Why is language And I've been guilty of this for sure. You know, I was one of the people in Philadelphia and other places fighting for safe injection facilities in the city because I believe in decriminalizing this stuff. I believe ultimately in legalizing this stuff. It may not sound like it from this interview, but I actually support the idea. And harm reduction was the language we used to convince a lot of, not just conservative folk.
Liberals.
Yeah, liberals, quite frankly, yeah. That this was a socially responsible and effective strategy for making our communities and our lives better. Why is harm reduction the wrong way to frame this?
Well, it's kind of a bait and switch. Let's just think about the supervised injection facilities or consumption facilities. Now, anybody who is getting high and using drugs like heroin or cocaine or what have you, you want to really do those drugs in the privacy of your own space where you can really let your hair down and do your thing. Nobody wants to go to a injection facility, whether it's nice or not, but it's a public space. The only people who are going to those facilities are people who don't have housing. And so what you have in effect is that you're pretending that you're doing something about a problem. And the problem is housing, not drugs. But we pretend that the problem is drugs. But the problem is housing. The problem has always been housing, employment, all of these things. And so wow. Liberals really love focusing on those things called harm reduction, when in fact, they don't focus on what the real problems are.
There's also an underlying presumption with supervisor safe injection facilities that you're trying to stop, right? And so it's like, we want you in these places so that you can get clean needles, so you can oversee, but it's also so there's treatment counselors, so people can help you not do this anymore if you have to do it. And it's treated purely as a medical problem, and it's something that it's a function of people's addiction rather than potentially a site of pleasure. This idea of drugs as a legitimate site of pleasure is what I found maybe the most provocative and interesting piece of your book.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, I wrote this book when I was a chair of the department, which I did from 16 to 19. I hated that role. And so I was trying to find pleasure and happiness and trying to express pleasure and happiness. But every time I talk about this book or make arguments, I'm always being brought down back into this sort of, what about this negative? What about this? It's like, I'm a drug user and have been for many years. And I don't use drugs to like reduce harm. I use drugs to enhance pleasure. To enhance pleasure, enhance the activity. It's a positive thing. That's the predominant effects are positive. But I'm always required to talk about these, what about this negative effect? What about this negative effect? As opposed to like showing people how to do this activity in a way that enhances the pleasure and minimizes potential harms.
Well, I think because some people are closeted about their drug use, we don't see people like you. We don't see people who use drugs and have joy and pleasure. The people I know who use heroin are the people asking me for money or the people who stole my shit. You know, the people
who... Well,
you know me,
I use heroin. You know
right,
me.
Right, and I'm saying, and as I'm saying, that's what makes your book so important is that now I have access to you, but the average person, before you even outed yourself, I mean, think about when you're about to get a medical procedure, you're about to get a colonoscopy, and even at that moment, you pause before you answer the question about... And so because most people, after they pause, don't make the decision you made, they keep it to themselves. Most people we know who admit to be drug users are doing so in the context of framing it as a problem or as an addiction or as a burden or as a site of shame. And so
yes.
I think that's why when you talk about it, the first instinct and the first response people are always going to have is, wait, you can do this and it be all right? Because we really don't know that. And I think that that's an important intervention. You make a very bold and I would argue courageous move by saying, right? Like, I'm not just a president, I'm also a client, right? Like,
you
say, look, I've been a regular drug user. You say for the past 5 years, it's been heroin.
It's heroin, yeah. But right. I mean, I've used the cocaine all my life and the rest of these drugs, MDMA, all my life, yes.
Right. Did you know when you began the book you were going to acknowledge that fact, or was it something you wrestled with? Was it something you and the publisher had to go back and forth about in terms of the level of disclosure, maybe your family? How did you work through that?
Well, that's a great question because the book I proposed originally before 16, I went to my editor and I was going to do some book on the addiction industry. And he was like, yo, we can do that, but it's not really what I've been hearing you tell me. And he's like, why don't you write the book you really want to write? And from that moment, I was like, bet. And he's like, just go for it. Do what you want to do. And then we'll worry about the fallout afterwards. And from that moment, that's when I decided I'm doing this because my family knew what I did. My wife, my children, they always knew. But it was this sort of duplicity that I living this lie. And then it's like, well, I need to reconcile this. And especially when I thought about all of the people who we persecute for doing the very same thing that I'm doing. And when you think about something like the gay lesbian issue, and we think about Stonewall during that time, and I think about Mayor Koch, New York City Mayor Koch. He wasn't the mayor at the time, but he was like a councilman in Manhattan, and he would enforce these ridiculous laws against the gay community. And, you know, I don't know if Mayor Koch ever came out as being gay, but there's some question of whether he really is. And it's like, the same behavior that he's probably engaged in, he is vilifying these folks for engaging it. And so I think about all the people who are in the closet. I think of them in the same way. These people are being vilified and you're being quiet and allowing this to happen when you're doing the same thing. When I was writing this book, I also traveled all around the world and got high with government officials, captains of industry, famous people. They're all in the closet. And so I made a decision that's like, you're out of my life if you are using drugs and I know it, and you ain't letting the public know this. It's like, I can't get down like that. And so there's a lot of people that I just dropped as a result.
Wow. Wow. Have you gotten any responses of shock or surprise or people who tried to drop you after they read this book or heard you interview about this book?
Not really. I know nobody dropped me or anything that I'm aware of, but, you know, I'm a very private person anyway. And so I wouldn't know, but the response has been amazing, particularly people who grapple with the arguments. There are so many people who've interviewed me and they confess that they have to get out of the closet on this book. And so I've been like pleasantly surprised. I didn't know what would happen with it, but what I did know is that the people who are being persecuted, it would be some salvation for them. And that's who I was thinking about as I wrote it.
I had a few conversations with people about this book and about this interview over the last few days. And I said, I've known him for a long time. I know he's been a regular drug user his entire life. He's not an addict. You define addiction in the book. You make it very clear what addiction is. It hasn't impaired his ability to work, to be a good father, a good partner, a good citizen, etc. And you know, I was having a hard time making the sale to somebody who ain't read the book yet.
Yeah.
But what they said is maybe he's in denial. Maybe this is a drug addict trying to convince. I said, nah, that ain't his jam. But I mean, you are going to get that response, right? There are going to be people who just refuse to believe that you can use anything like heroin or cocaine regularly. And not just you personally, but that anyone can.
I know. I feel you. And you know, that's right. And so I just say, check the record. I mean, you look at my level of productivity and then you look at like my kids. My kids are one graduated from Ivy League and another on his way graduating from Ivy League schools. And so it's like, check the record. Just check the record. I mean, I can't say anything else. I don't know. I know few people who are as productive as I am. And so it's like, I don't really care what they say. I'm 54 at this stage in my life. I'm trying to retire and do more drugs and enjoy my life. That's what I'm trying to do. So
I got to tell you, this is purely my curiosity. How often do you do heroin?
Now that we have this pandemic, almost never, because I can't leave the country. You know, like the heroin I do is from Afghanistan, you know.
Oh, shit.
This is the thing that I try to get people to understand, that your drugs have to be tested. And this is where the United States... It's criminal what we're doing. On the one hand, we're saying we have this opioid crisis. And the reason that we have people dying from drugs is largely because of tainted drugs. People are seeking heroin, and then they, unbeknownst to them, they get something like a fentanyl analog. We can solve that problem by simply having these things where in neighborhoods where people can go and test their drugs, small samples of their drugs, and get a chemical printout of what's contained in their substance, and they can get some education about each compound in their substance and at what dose. We have that technology. We have not made it available to the public. The Spanish have done this. The Dutch have done this. The Swiss, the Colombians, people around the world have done this sort of thing. But the United States, we haven't done it. It's criminal.
Wow, that's helpful. So in the age of the pandemic, you actually haven't been able to do this kind of stuff, which is interesting. Under ideal circumstances, how often would you do it?
Oh, under ideal circumstances, I would. If I had good Afghanistan heroin, I would do heroin, like people do alcohol. You come to the crib, after a long day at work, you know, I would have a couple of lines and chill. And that helps me to like recalibrate, to be more forgiving and to think about what negative impact my behavior has had on other people, particularly subordinates, and, you know, and try and think about how to correct that sort of thing. Heroin, that's what heroin does for me. But, you know, there are other drugs like MDMA. It's a great drug to like enhance empathy, to have connection with your loved one. I think about the receptions that we have to attend as faculty members. The only drug that, the only drugs that's available is alcohol. It's like a speedball, something like an opioid and a stimulant like cocaine or amphetamine. That'd be excellent for those situations. Well, you can be forgiving on the one hand, and you can also be like upbeat and energetic on the other hand. A lot better than alcohol for me. That would be a lot better. But in the book, I try to explain some of these effects, and I try to get people to think about drugs outside of the adolescent sort of way that we talk about drugs in this country. It's maddening for somebody who has grown up to be treated like a fucking infant. And that's what they do in this country.
How do we manage the process of outing ourselves as drug users if we are? How do we manage the process of advancing the conversation on drug use in a world where the reality is it's still illegal? So, I mean, you talked about the dilemma of saying, okay, well, I can tell my doctor I use these drugs, but they could also call child services and take my kid. I could tell my job that, yeah, I came to the faculty meeting speedballing it, but they could then use that later on as an excuse to fire me if I have another kind of conflict. I mean, I'm just thinking about the possibilities there. How do we navigate that in a real world where even as we shift our cultural practices, the law is different? We're still wrestling with that with weed sometimes, but with these other things where the stigma's still heavy, how do we do that?
Like I said, life is not without risk. Many of us have as our heroes, people like Rosa Parks, MLK, all of these people we think of as heroes. And we value those people and we revere those people because they took great risks, personal risks, in order to advance or in order to highlight an injustice. And so if people are looking for an easy way out here, I don't have one. You know, that's not what this is about. This is about you standing up and doing what's right. And so on the one hand, we have allowed liberals to say the war on drugs is bad. I read the new Jim Crow. They can say this sort of thing, but they don't have to interrogate further, like the assumptions on which the war on drugs are built. The assumptions on which the war on drugs are built is that drugs are evil and drugs are causing all of these problems. Those are the assumptions. When you interrogate those assumptions, they're wrong. That's not true. And if that's not true, then you have to reconsider what you're doing and why you're doing it, particularly in light of the country's promise of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And so when you think about all of this stuff together, you really got some work to do. You can't simply say, I'm against the war on drugs. I read the new Jim Crow. No, that's some superficial first grade, first level stuff. You have to take it further.
You identify as a scientist. In this book, you also are looking at social theory or social science, at least literature. You're looking at, you're reading Jefferson, you're talking about Benjamin Franklin. I mean, you're taking us through a variety of discourses. What does it mean for you as a scientist to be writing to the broader public and engaging these other disciplines?
Science is nothing but a methodology. One of the things we've done in this country, and we've given priority to biological sciences over social sciences, but they all are science, and science is simply a way of investigating a problem. That's all that is. And so we act as if like social science is not equally valued, when in fact, a lot of social science is a lot more rigorous than the biological science. And so I think as an educated person, it's incumbent upon you to learn other literatures. And that's what I'm trying to do. I've been trying to do this all my life. And this is where I'm at this point in my life. Hopefully I keep learning and keep growing.
What's the biggest shift for you as you begin, and you've done this over the last two books, what's the biggest shift for you as a writer in terms of your writing process, in terms of how your mind works, when you're no longer writing to, you know, journals like Psychopharmacology, but instead you're writing to somebody who's going in a bookstore, pulling a book off a shelf and wants to learn something about which they don't know a whole lot?
Yeah, when I write scientific journals, I can like turn off my brain because your writing doesn't have to be good. Whereas, as you know, you've written for the general audience for a while. It's hard. I mean, it's very hard because you have to be able to distill complex sort of ideas, information in a way that people who are not experts in an area can understand. And that's a hard thing to do. And you have to also have stories and anecdotes to illustrate a point. And you have to understand the limitations of the anecdotes, and you have to understand the limitations of the science. And now you have to make sense of it for the reader, which is hard. So I am always writing, even when I'm not writing. So I'm always writing down anecdotes, something that happened, something that my wife said, something that somebody said. I'm always doing that so I can illustrate it for the reader who is not an expert in the area that I may be trying to explain. But I'm an infant, and when it comes to writing for a general audience, I'm still trying to get better at that.
What's your process? You write every day?
I don't physically write something every day, but I'm always writing, like journaling at night next to the bed. There is something there because I have ideas, and so I have to use it, the ideas. And so I'm always putting down notes, journals, some funny stuff that happened. I love comedy. I'm always getting ideas from comedians, and I'm always trying to figure out how, like, comedians think about, like, how you have a punchline, and now how do you build a story around it? So I do that a lot, too, in my writing. So I write down a note and then figure out how to build a story around it.
How often do you get to the keyboard? Is there a ritual? Is there a schedule? Or is it just when you feel like you've gotten enough anecdotes and notes there?
Oh, when I'm writing something, like now, I'm working on another book. And so I'm constantly at the keyboard. But when I'm at the keyboard, it's like I can't write less than like 8 hours straight. And then I can do it sometime for 16 hours because the ideas, I'm just fighting with them. And when if I let it go, it's harder to get back in that mode. And so like when people think about, well, you know, he's in denial about his drug use. It's like they have no idea what it takes to produce a book. They just have no idea. Whoever says that.
Do drugs enhance your ability to write? I mean, I know they can.
Of course. Of course.
What's your drug of choice as a writer? Adderall?
I don't know if I explained this in this book, but Adderall is not the drug to use. Adderall is a drug that combines three amphetamines. But the main amphetamine that people are seeking is the amphetamine. And Adderall has other amphetamines that just produce sort of peripheral effects like increased heart rate, blood pressure. You don't want that if you can avoid that. So you just want the stuff in the brain, and that's the D-amphetamine. That's my drug of choice for writing. But sometimes I may have to take an opioid to like chill if I'm too anxious about some deadline or something. But usually it's amphetamine. I think back to the writers that I respected in history, James Baldwin, Lorraine Hansberry, all of those people. Maya Angelou said of her process, she used to like take something like several quarts of alcohol and go to a hotel and just write. But her drug of choice seemed to have been alcohol. It's like, if I was around, I could have helped her. It's like, that's okay, but the amphetamine would have been probably, we would have probably got more stuff out of her. But it doesn't really matter. The stuff that we got out of her was so brilliant. It's a good thing. So I don't mean to make any criticism of her in any way because I can learn from her. But amphetamines, that's a drug of choice for writing for me.
Before we go, help me think about three books that help shift your worldview. When I see drug use for grownups, I see a book that will radically change the way someone understands the world. A book that will shift someone's thinking dramatically on an issue. Things we just took for granted aren't there anymore. What are three books that did that for you?
The Fire Next Time, that was a book that was important because it was about Black people. And I came up in an age when they didn't have us read books about Black people, you know, in Miami at that time. That was an important one. Herman Hesse's Siddhartha, I got that when I was first starting on my journey to learn how to think. And The Jungle by Upton Sinclair.
Ooh.
When his sort of a focus on the worker. So those are three books that were important.
Wow. Those are all three great, great books, powerful books that really reflect this idea of shifting one's worldview. And all those books can be ordered at Uncle Bobby's, y'all. And of course, you can order Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear by Dr. Carl L. Hart. Carl, good to see you, brother. Thank you so much.
You too, man.
Where can people find you online?
DrCarlHart.com. That's DrCarlHart.com. And you can follow me at Twitter, Dr. Carl Hart. You can find me there.
Okay, cool, man. Make sure y'all follow him. Make sure you check out this book. I promise you, it will change the way you understand some stuff. We'll see you next week. Stay with us. Peace. Thank you for listening to Coffee and Books. Make sure to follow us on Instagram with the handle Coffee and Books Show. That's Coffee A-N-D Books Show. Also, you can buy all the books that I've been discussing here at bookshop.org/shop/UncleBobby's, or you can go straight to UncleBobby's.com. That's Uncle B-O-B-B-I-E-S.com.